torrents of rain. Her white slip was plastered to her body and quite transparent, her small nipples in the divot of her navel plainly visible. She made no move to cover herself. Feral averted his eyes. Ruby turned to Sparrow and conceded, with evident surprise.
You know, you're right. It's not like kissing ghosts. It's warmer. And wetter.
She laughed and shook her head, fountaining spumes of rain from the ends of her hair.
A lot wetter.
Sparrow didn't share her laughter. Stricken, the girl spun on one bare heel and darted back out to the garden. Ruby turned to Sarai.
What's wrong with her?
She asked, perfectly oblivious to what had been clear to Sarai for months now. That Sparrow's affection for Feral had changed from the sisterly feelings they all had for him into something, well, to use Ruby's words, warmer. Sarai wasn't going to explain it to Ruby, or to Feral, who was equally oblivious. It was just one of the ways life was getting more complicated as they grew up. She slapped at her wet slip and sighed. At least hers was dark grey, and so hadn't gone see-through like Ruby's. But she would still have to change.
It's almost dinner time, she said to Ruby. I suggest you get dry.
Ruby looked down at herself, then back up at Sarai.
All right,
she said, and Sarai saw the telltale spark in her eye.
Not like that,
she said, but it was too late. Ruby burst into flames. Sarai had to lurch back from the blast of heat as Ruby was engulfed in a crackling, deep orange column of fire. It kindled in an instant, like lamp oil kissed by a spark, but died more slowly, the flames receding until her form was visible within them, her flesh absorbing each lick of fire one by one. Her eyes were the last reservoir of flame, burning as red as her name, so that she looked, for a second, like a temple icon to an evil goddess. And then she was just herself again. Herself, and only herself. Nary a shred or ashen tatter remaining of her dress. They called her Bonfire, for obvious reasons. While a baby Feral might have caused inconvenience, a baby Ruby had had a more dangerous effect, compounded by the volatility of her nature. It was a good thing, then, that their nursemaids had been dead already. Ghosts were not combustible, and neither was Mazathium, so there had been no risk of her setting the citadel alight.
All dry,
said the girl, and so she was. Her hair, unburned, was wild once more, still crackling with the fire's kinesis, and Sarai knew that if she touched it, it would feel like a bed of coals, and so would her bare skin. She shook her head, glad Sparrow had missed this display. Feral was still standing with his back turned.
Tell me when it's safe to look, he said, bored.
Sarai told Ruby,
That was a waste of a dress.
Ruby shrugged.
What does it matter? We won't live long enough to run out of dresses.
Her voice was so casual, so matter-of-fact, that her words swept past all of Sarai's defences and pierced her. It was more of a shock than the rain.
Won't live long enough. Ruby!
Said Sarai. Feral, equally shocked, turned back around, naked girl or not.
Is that really what you think?
He asked her.
What? You don't?
Ruby looked genuinely amazed. Standing there fire-dried and beautiful, naked, at ease with herself, and blue. Blue as opals, pale blue. Blue as cornflowers, or dragonfly wings, or a spring, not summer, sky. Just like the rest of them. Blue as five murders waiting to happen.
You think we're going to grow old here?
She asked, looking back and forth between them, gesturing to the walls around them.
You must be joking. Is that really a future you can picture?
Sarai blinked. It wasn't a question she allowed herself to ask. They did their best. They obeyed the rule. Sometimes she almost believed it would be enough.
A lot of things could happen, she said,
and heard how half her voice was carved away by uncertainty, and how utterly weak she sounded.
Like what?
Ruby asked.
Besides dying, I mean.
And Sarai couldn't think of a single thing. Chapter 13 Purgatory Soup. Sarai stepped out of her clammy, wet slip and let it fall to the floor of her dressing room. Puddled grey silk on the blue metal floor. Blue toes, blue legs, blue self-reflected in the blue mirror, which wasn't glass, but only more mesarthium, polished to a high gloss. The only thing that wasn't blue was her hair, which was the red-brown of cinnamon, and the whites of her eyes. The whites of her teeth, too, if she were smiling. But she very much wasn't.
We won't live long enough to run out of dresses, Ruby had said.
Sarai regarded the row of slips hanging from the slim mesarthium dowel. There were so many, and all so fine. And yes, they were underclothes, but she and Ruby and Sparrow preferred them to the alternative, the gowns. The only clothes they had, or would ever have, like the only life they had, or would ever have, was what the Citadel provided. And the Citadel provided the garments of dead goddesses. The dressing room was as large as a lounge. There were dozens of gowns, all of them too grand to wear, and too terrible. Satins and foils, and stiff brocades, encrusted with jewels and trimmed in furs, with the head still on, glassy eyes, bared fangs and all. One had a skirt like a cage carved of whalebone, another a long train made of hundreds of dove's wings, all stitched together. There was a bodice of pure moulded gold, made to look like a beetle's carapace, and a fan collar fashioned from the spines of poisonous fish, with tiny teeth sewn in patterns like seed pearls. There were headdresses and veils, corsets with daggers concealed in the stays, elaborate capes, and teetering tall shoes carved of ebony and coral. Everything was gaudy and heavy and cruel. To Sarai, they were clothes a monster might wear if it were trying to pass as human. Which was near enough to the truth. The monster had been Isagol, goddess of despair. Her mother, dead now these 15 years. Sarai had 1,000 memories of Isagol, but none of them were her own. She'd been too young, only 2 years old when it happened. It. The carnage. Knife shine and spreading blood. The end of one world and start of another. Her memories of her mother were all second-hand, borrowed from the humans she visited in the night. In some, the goddess was alive. In others, dead. She'd been murdered in an iridescent green gown, jeweled with jade and beetle wings, and she'd looked enough like Sarai that the visions of her body were like seeing a prophecy of her own death. Except for the black bar Isagol had painted across her eyes, temple to temple, like a slim mask. Sarai eyed the shelf of her mother's paints and perfumes. The pot of lamp black was right there, untouched in all this time. Sarai didn't use it. She had no desire to look more like the goddess of despair than she already did. She focused on the slips. She had to get dressed. White silk or scarlet or black trimmed in burgundy. Gold or chartreuse or pink as the dawn sky. She kept hearing the echo of Ruby's words.
Won't live long enough.
And seeing in the row of slips 2 possible endings. In one, she was murdered, and they went unworn. Humans burned or shredded them, and they burned and shredded her, too. In the other, she lived and spent years working her way through them all. Ghosts laundered them and hung them back up, again and again over years. And she wore them out one by one, and eventually grew old in them.
It seemed so far-fetched,
the idea of growing old, that she had to admit to herself, finally, that she had no more real hope of the future than Ruby did. It was a brutal revelation. She chose black to suit her mood and returned to the gallery for dinner. Ruby had come back from her own dressing room, clad in a slip so sheer she might as well have stayed naked. She was making tiny flames dance off her fingertips, while Feral leaned over his big book of symbols, ignoring her.
"Minya and Sparrow?"
Sarai asked them.
"Sparrow's still in the garden, pouting about something,"
said Ruby, her self-absorption apparently admitting no hint as to what that something might be.
"Minya hasn't turned up."
Sarai wondered at that. Minya was usually waiting to pester her as soon as she came out of her room.
"Tell me something nasty,"
she would say, bright-eyed, eager to hear about her night.
"Did you make anyone cry? Did you make anyone scream?"
For years, Sarai had been happy to tell her all about it. Not anymore.
"I'll fetch Sparrow," she said.
The garden was a broad terrace that stretched the breadth of the citadel, abutting the high, indomitable body of the structure on one side, and falling away to a sheer drop on the other, edged only by a hip-high balustrade. It had been formal once, but now was wild. Shrubs that had been tidy topiaries had grown into great shaggy trees, and bowers of blooming vines had overspilled their neat beds to riot up the walls and columns and drape over the railing. Nature flourished, but not on its own. It couldn't, not in this unnatural place. It was Sparrow who made it flourish. Sarai found her gathering Anadni blossoms. Anadni was the sacred flower of Letha, goddess of oblivion. Distilled, it made Lull, the draught Sarai drank to keep her from dreaming.
"Thank you for doing that," Sarai said.
Sparrow looked up and smiled at her.
"Oh, I don't mind. Great Ellen said it was time for a new batch."
She dropped a handful of flowers into her bowl and dusted off her palm.
"I just wish you didn't need it, Sarai. I wish you were free to dream."
So did Sarai, but she wasn't free, and wishing wouldn't make her so.
"I might not have my own dreams," she said,
as though it scarcely mattered.
"But I have everyone else's." "It's not the same. That's like reading 1,000 diaries instead of writing your own."
1,000? Said Sarai.
"More like 100,000.
Which was close to the population of Weep.
"So many,"
said Sparrow, marveling.
"How do you keep them straight?"
Sarai shrugged.
"I don't know that I do. But you can learn a lot in 4,000 nights." 4,000? Have we been alive so long?
Longer than that, silly.
Where do the days go?
There was such sweetness in Sparrow's wisp of a smile. She was as sweet as the scent of the garden, and as gentle. And Sarai couldn't help thinking how perfectly her gift suited her. Orchid Witch, they called her. She felt the pulse of life in things, and nursed it forth to make them grow. She was, Sarai thought, like springtime distilled into a person. Ruby's gift, too, was an extension of her nature. Bonfire, blazing like a beacon, burning like a wildfire out of control. And Minya and Feral, did their gifts suit them? Sarai didn't like the thought, because if it was so, and their abilities spoke some essential truth about their souls, what did that say about her?
"I was just thinking,"
said Sparrow,
"how our waking life is like the citadel. Enclosed, I mean. Indoors, no sky. But dreaming is like the garden. You can step out of prison and feel the sky around you. In a dream you can be anywhere. You can be free. You deserve to have that too, Sarai."
"If the citadel is our prison,"
Sarai replied,
"it's our sanctuary too.
She plucked a white blossom from its stem and dropped it into Sparrow's bowl.
It's the same with Lal.
Sleep might be a grey wasteland to her, but she knew what was lurking beyond the safe circle of Lal, and she was glad of the grey.
Besides, she said, my dreams wouldn't be like a garden.
She tried not to envy that sparrows were, or that her gift was such a simple and beautiful one, while her own was neither.
Maybe one day they can be,
said Sparrow.
Maybe,
said Sarai, and hope had never felt like such a lie.
Let's go have dinner, she said,
and together they went inside.
Good evening, brood.
Les Ellen greeted them, carrying a tureen from the kitchen. Like Great Ellen, Les Ellen had been with them from the beginning. She had worked in the Citadel nursery, too, and with two Ellens, a distinction had been needed. The one being greater in both status and size, so it was that Scathis himself, the god of beasts and high lord of the Mazarthim, had dubbed them the Greater and Lesser Ellens. Ruby breathed a woeful sigh as her dinner was put before her.
Kimrel soup, again.
She scooped up a spoonful and let it dribble back into her bowl. It was beige, with the consistency of stagnant water.
You know what this is? It's purgatory soup.
Turning to Sparrow, she asked,
couldn't you grow something new for us to eat? Certainly I could,
Sparrow replied, a tartness in her tone that had not been there when she was speaking with Sarai.
If my gift were conjuring seeds from thin air.
She took a dainty sip from her spoon.
Which it isn't.
Sparrow might make things grow, but she had to have something to start with. For the most part, the Citadel gardens had been ornamental, full of exotic flowers, with little in the way of edibles. It was their good luck that some long-ago gardener had made a small kitchen garden of herbs, fresh greens, and a few vegetables. And their very good luck that their sometime visitor, the great white bird they called Wraith, for its habit of vanishing into thin air, had seen fit to drop some Kimrel tubers into the garden once, else they'd have starved long ago. Kimrel was easy to grow, nourishing though nearly flavorless, and was now the staple of their boring diet. Sarai wondered if the bird knew that it had made the difference between life and death for five blue abominations, or if it had simply been a fluke. It had never brought them anything else, so she supposed it must be the latter. Sparrow grew their food. Feral kept the rain barrels filled. Ruby did her part, too. There was no fuel to burn, so she burned. She made the fires that cooked their meals and heated their baths. And Minya, well, she was responsible for the ghosts, who did most of the work. Sarai was the only one who had no part in the mundane tasks of their days.
Purgatory soup, she thought,
stirring hers with her spoon. The simplest possible fare, served on the finest porcelain, and set on an elaborate charger of chased silver. Her goblet was chased silver, too, in a design of twined mirantine branches. Once upon a time, the gods had drunk wine from it. Now there was only rainwater. Once upon a time, there had been gods. Now there were only children going about in their dead parents' undergarments.
I can't do it any more, said Ruby,
dropping her spoon into her soup. It splattered the table in the front of her new slip.
I can't put one more bite of this insipid mush into my mouth. Must you be so dramatic?
Beryl asked, bypassing his spoon in favor of tipping back his bowl and drinking from it.
It's not as though it's terrible. At least we still have some salt in the pantry. Imagine when that runs out. I didn't say it was terrible, said Ruby. If it was terrible, it wouldn't be purgatory soup, would it? It would be hell soup, which would have to be more interesting.
Mm-hmm,
agreed Sparrow.
In the same way that being eternally tortured by demons is more interesting than not being eternally tortured by demons.
They had an ongoing debate on the merits of interesting. Ruby contended that it was always worth it, even if it came with danger and ended in doom.
Purgatory's more than just not being tortured,
she argued now.
It's not being anything, ever. You might not be tortured, but you'll also never be touched. Touched?
Sparrow's eyebrows went up.
How did we get to touching? Don't you want to be touched?
Ruby's eyes glimmered red, and the corners of her lips curled up, feline. There was such longing in her words, such hunger.
Don't you wish you had someone to sneak off and do things with?
Sparrow flushed at this, a roseate warmth creeping into the blue of her cheeks and giving them a violet cast. She darted a glance at Feral, who didn't notice. He was looking at Ruby.
Don't get any ideas, he told her flat. You've debauched me enough for one day.
Ruby rolled her eyes.
Please. That's an experiment I won't be repeating. You're a terrible kisser.
Me?
He demanded.
That was all you. I didn't even do anything.
That's why it was terrible. You're supposed to do something. It's not facial paralysis. It's kissing.
More like drowning.
I never knew one person could produce so much saliva. My darlings, my vipers,
came the soothing voice of Great Ellen, floating into the room. Her voice floated, and she floated after it. She didn't touch the floor. She didn't bother with the illusion of walking. Great Ellen, more than any other ghost, had shed all pretense of mortality. Ghosts were not bound by the same laws as the living. If they appeared exactly as they had in life, it was because they chose to, either out of believing themselves perfect as is, or from fear of losing their last touchstone to reality, in the form of their own familiar face. Or, as in the case of Kem the footman, because it just didn't occur to them to change. That was relatively rare, though. Most of them, given time, made at least small adjustments to their phantom forms. Les Ellen, for example, had, while alive, been in possession of but a single eye, the other having been extracted by a goddess in a foul mood. But in death she restored it, and made both eyes larger and thicker lashed in the bargain. But it was Great Ellen who was the true master of the post-mortal state. Her imagination was an instrument of wonder, and she fashioned, of the stuff of her ghostliness, an ever-shifting expression of her marvelous self. This evening, she wore a bird's nest for a crown, and an elegant green bird was perched in it, singing. It was only an illusion, but a perfect illusion. Her face was more or less her own, a matron's face, cheeks high, red and round. Happiness cheeks, Sarai called them. But in place of her wool-white hair were leaves, streaming behind her as though caught in a breeze. She set a basket of biscuits on the table. Kimril flour biscuits, as bland as the soup.
No more of your sniping and snarling, she said. What's this about kissing?
Oh, nothing, said Feral. Ruby tried to drown me in saliva, that's all.
Come to think of it, has anyone seen Kem lately?
He's not dead in a puddle of drool somewhere, is he?
Well, he's definitely dead, remarked Sarai. I couldn't say about the drool. He's probably hiding, said Sparrow. Or maybe pleading with Minya to release him from his torment.
Ruby was unfazed.
Say what you like. He loved it. I bet he's writing a poem about it.
Sarai let out a muffled snort at the idea of Kem writing a poem. Great Ellen sighed.
Those lips will lead you into trouble, my pretty flame.
I hope so. Where is Minya, anyway?
Asked Great Ellen, regarding the girl's empty chair.
I thought she might be with you,
said Sarai. Great Ellen shook her head.
I haven't seen her all day.
I checked her rooms,
said Ruby.
She wasn't there either.
They all looked at one another. It wasn't as though one could go missing in the Citadel. Not unless you took a leap off the terrace, anyway. Which Sarai thought Minya the least likely of the five of them to do.
Where could she be?
Mused Sparrow.
I haven't seen much of her lately, said Feral. I wonder where she's been spending her time. Are you missing me?
Asked a voice from behind them. It was a child's voice, bell bright and as sweet as icing sugar. Sarai turned, and there was Minya in the doorway. A six-year-old child, to all appearances. She was grubby and round-faced and stick-limbed. Her eyes were big and glossy as only a child's or spectral's can be, minus the innocence of either.
Where have you been?
Great Ellen asked her.
Just making friends,
said the little girl.
Am I late for dinner? What is it? Not soup again.
That's what I said,
chimed Ruby. Minya came forward, and it became clear what she meant by making friends. She was leading a ghost behind her like a pet. He was newly dead, his face blank with shock, and Sarai felt a tightness in her throat. Not another one. He moved in Minya's wake, stiffly, as though fighting a compulsion. He might strain all he liked. He was hers now, and no amount of struggle would restore his free will. This was Minya's gift. She fished spirits from the air and bound them to her service. Thus was the Citadel staffed with the dead. A dozen servants to see to the needs of five children, who were no longer children. She didn't have a moniker, the way Feral was Cloud Thief, and Ruby was Bonfire, and Sparrow was Orchid Witch. Sarai had a name too, but Minya was just Minya, or Mistress, to the ghosts she bound in iron gossamers of will. It was an extraordinary power. After death, souls were invisible, incorporeal, and ephemeral, lasting a few days at the most between death and evanescence, during which time they could only cling to their bodies or drift helplessly upward toward their final unmaking. Unless, that is, Minya caught and kept them. They were made solid by her binding, substance and matter, if not flesh and blood. They had hands to work with, mouths to kiss with. They could speak, dance, love, hate, cook, teach, tickle, and even rock babies to sleep at night, but only if Minya let them. They were hers to control. This one was a man. He still wore the semblance of his worldly body. Sarai knew him. Of course she did. She knew the people of Weep better than anyone, including their leaders, including their priestesses. They were her dark work. They were her knights. Sooner or later, they would all die and find themselves at Minya's mercy. But while they lived, it was Sarai's mercy that mattered.
Tell us your name,
Minya commanded the ghost. He gritted his teeth, choking to keep his name to himself. He held out for 4 or 5 seconds and looked exhausted but determined. He didn't understand that Minya was toying with him. She was leaving him just enough will to believe he stood a chance against her. It was cruel, like opening a birdcage to let the bird fly out, whilst all the while it's tethered by the leg, and freedom is only an illusion. Minya marshalled a dozen ghosts at all times, even in her sleep. Her power over them was entire. If she wanted him to say his name, he would say his name. If she wanted him to sing it, he would sing it. Just now, it amused her to let him believe he could resist her. Sarai said nothing. She couldn't help him. She shouldn't want to. He would kill her if he could, and the others too. If he were alive, he would rip them apart with his bare hands. And she couldn't really blame him for it. Finally, Minya tore his name from his lips.
Auriel!
He gasped.
You're young,
said Ruby, who was fixed on him with uncommon interest.
How did you die? Did someone kill you?
She asked, in much the same tone as if she were inquiring after his health. He stared at them in raw horror, his eyes skipping from Ruby to Feral to Sparrow to Sarai, trying to process the sight of their blue flesh. Blue. As blue as tyranny and thrall and monsters in the streets. His eyes caught on Sarai for a long, tremulous moment, and she knew what he was seeing. Izagol the Terrible, resurrected from the dead. But Sarai's face was too young, and must seem naked without the black band painted across her eyes. She wasn't Izagol. She saw it dawn on him. What she was, if not who. What they all were.
Godspawn,
he whispered, and Sarai felt his revulsion as powerfully as though it, too, were given substance by Minya's binding. The air felt slippery with it. Rank. He shook his head and squeezed his eyes shut, as though he could deny their existence. It served as an affirmation, if nothing else. Every new ghost who recoiled from them in shock proved that they had not yet broken the rule. The rule, the one and only. Self-imposed, it contained, in its simplicity, countless forbiddens. If they lived 1,000 years, they'd still be discovering new things they mustn't do. No evidence of life. That was it. The four-word mantra that governed their existence. They must betray no evidence of life. At all costs, the Citadel must appear abandoned. They must remain hidden and give the humans no hint that they were here, or that, unthinkably, 5 abominations had survived the carnage and eked out an existence here for 15 years. In this ghost's reaction, they saw that all was well. They were still a secret. The fruits of slaughter slipped through bloody fingers.
You're dead,
he said, almost pleading for it to be true.
We killed you.
About that, said Ruby.
Minya gave the ghost's invisible leash a tug that felled him to his knees.
We're not dead, she said. But you are.
He must have known already. But the plain words were a sucker punch. He looked around, taking it all in. This place that he only knew from his worst nightmares.
Is this hell?
He asked, hoarse. Ruby laughed.
I wish, she said. Welcome to purgatory. Care for some soup?
Chapter 14. Beautiful and full of monsters. Laszlo clutched his spear and moved slowly over the desert sand. Ruza on his left, Zara on his right. The 2 Tizakane held spears as well. And though Ruza had been teaching him to throw, Laszlo still felt like an imposter.
I won't be any help if it comes to it, he'd said, before they set out on their hunt.
The creature they sought was something out of stories. He'd never imagined they were real, much less that he would ever track one.
Don't underestimate yourself, Ferengi,
Ruza had replied, his voice full of assurance.
I can always push you into its mouth and run. So you see, you'll have saved my life, and I'll never forget it.
Nice, Laszlo had said. That's exactly the sort of heroism that inspired me to play Tizakane as a little boy.
It won't come to anything,
Zara had cut in, giving Ruza a shove.
We're just going to poke it. You can't appreciate a thrieve until you've seen one. That's all.
Just poke it. Poke a monster. And then?
Behold the horror,
Errol Fane had said, approving the excursion. The caravan had adjusted its course to give the thing a wide berth. But Ruza had been keen for Laszlo to see the Almuthaleth's ugliest species. Threaves were ambush predators. They burrowed under the sand and lay in wait, for years even, for prey to happen along. And they were only a threat if you had the poor fortune of walking over one. But thanks to the caravan's threave hawks, they knew exactly where the thing was. Low in the sky, one of the birds flew circles to mark the place where the threave lay buried. The caravans had always employed falconers with special birds that could scent the stench of the creatures and avoid them, and occasionally to hunt them, as they were doing now, though with no intent to kill. They were only 20 yards from it, and the back of Laszlo's neck prickled. He'd never stalked anything before.
It knows we're coming, Ruza said. It can feel the vibrations of our footsteps. It must be getting excited. Its mouth will be filling with digestive juices, all bubbly and hot. It would be like falling into a bath if it ate you. A really awful bath.
He was the youngest of the Tyzicane, only 18, and had been the first to make Laszlo welcome. Not that any of them had made him unwelcome. It was just that Ruza had an eager nature, eager to tease more than anything else, and had taken it upon himself to teach Laszlo basic skills, such as riding, spear-throwing, cursing. He was a good language teacher all around, mainly because he talked so much. But he was unreliable, as Laszlo had discovered early on, when he'd asked Azarine, Errol Fane's second-in-command, what turned out to mean not, can I help you with that, but, would you like to sniff my armpits? She had declined. That was early on. His unseen had improved enough now to know when Ruza was trying to trick him, which was most of the time.
Hush, said Sara. Watch the sand.
Laszlo did. The hawk drew a circle with its shadow, but he saw no hint within of buried beasts. There was nothing to distinguish the sand there from the sand anywhere. Sara stopped short.
Would you like to do the honors?
She asked him. She was another of the younger warriors. Her face was smooth and bronze, with a high-bridged, regal nose, and a scar bisecting her right eyebrow. She wore her head shaved, all but an inch-thick strip down the center of her scalp, which she left long and wove into a single braid.
Honors?
Asked Laszlo. She handed him a pebble.
Just throw it in.
Laszlo held his spear in one hand and the pebble in the other. He stared at the stretch of sand and the shadow of the bird going round and round, took a deep breath, and tossed the pebble. It arced through the air, and he did expect something to happen. He even expected it to be monstrous, but perhaps there was no preparing for one's first monster. The instant the pebble struck the surface of the sand, the desert floor erupted. Sand flew. It stung his face and got in his eyes, so that the thing that sprang up in front of him was at first sight just a big, bristling blur. He leapt backward, spear heavy in his hand, and managed to trip over his own feet and land with a thud sitting down. Ruza and Sara didn't fall back, though, or even heft their spears. And so he took his cue from their calm, wiped the sand from his eyes, and stared. It was like an immense spider, he thought, his mind groping for comparisons that might make sense of the thing. But it didn't make sense. It might resemble a great, bloated abdomen bristling with legs, but the proportions were wrong. The legs were too short and couldn't possibly lift the creature's bulk. They weren't legs at all, Laszlo realized. They were chelicerae. Mouthparts. They were moving wildly,
a dozen black bristled appendages roughly the size of his own arms, and with pincers for grasping prey and dragging it toward its mouth. Laszlo couldn't tell how much of the Threave lay buried still beneath the sand, but from what he could see, it was made up almost entirely of mouth. It didn't even have eyes, just a great pulsating sphincter, gaping, tooth-spiked, hot and red. The Calissary writhed, questing for prey, and the sphincter more spasmed, teeth clicking open and shut, searching for something to bite into. Finding nothing, it hissed out a blast of hot air flecked with something foul. The digestive juices Ruza had mentioned? Like a really awful bath, indeed. Laszlo had to wonder how many adventurers, crossing the desert without the benefit of Threave Hawks, had ended their quest in jaws like these.
Nature's booby trap,
Ruza called it. And they left it there, unharmed, to await the next wave of Ferengi adventurers foolish enough to attempt the crossing. They rejoined the caravan, which had stopped to make camp.
Well? Asked Errol Fane. What do you say about Threaves?
I need to amend my ways I hope not to die list, said Laszlo.
Errol Fane laughed.
Indeed. We might have come west sooner, you know. But no one had trained a Threave Hawk in 200 years. We decided to wait until that had been mastered.
Wise decision, said Laszlo.
200 years. The first mystery of Weep, the one that had opened his mind like a door.
My city lost the world, and was lost to it,
Errol Fane had said back in Zosma. Laszlo had been daily in his company ever since, and was no closer to knowing what any of it meant. Soon, though. Tomorrow.
I'm going to put up the fog nets, he said.
You needn't,
Errol Fane replied. He was carrying his spectral, Sir Angelus.
We have enough water for tomorrow.
The nets were designed to leach condensation out of the cool night air, and were an important supplementary source of water in the Elmuthaleth. It was the last night of their crossing, though, and the water in the skins would last until they reached their destination. Laszlo shrugged.
There's nothing like freshly harvested fog, he said,
and went off to do it anyway. The water in the skins was 2 months stale, and besides, he'd gotten used to the labor, which involved an ironwood mallet and pounding stakes deep into the sand. It loosened him up after a long day in the saddle, and though he would have been embarrassed to admit it, he liked the change it had made to his body. When he stripped off his white shulno to bathe, what passed for bathing in the desert, that is, scrubbing his skin with a mixture of sand and pulverized nagao root, there was a hardness and sculpt that hadn't been there before. Even his hands hardly seemed his own these days. Before, he'd had a single callus from holding his pen. Now his palms were tough all over, and the backs of his hands were as brown as his face. His grey eyes seemed shades lighter by contrast to his darkened skin. And the months of travelling into the sun hadn't only earned him squint lines. They had reshaped his eyes, cutting them narrower against the light, and altered the line of his brow, drawing it forward and knitting it between his black eyebrows in a single furrow. Those small changes wrought an undue transformation, replacing his dreamy vagueness with a hunting intensity. Such was the power of a half-year of horizons. Laszlo had reason to know that he bore little resemblance now to the junior librarian, who'd ridden out of Zosma 6 months ago with the Tizercane. In fact, when the delegates had all assembled in Alkenost to cross the desert together, Thion Nero had failed to recognize him. It had been 4 months by then since they had seen each other last, and, to Laszlo's surprise, the Golden Godson had several times passed him right by in the caravansary before registering, with a visible start, who he was. with his long dark hair and hooded white shulno, riding a spectral with panache, and speaking unseen as though his smoky voice were made for it. Laszlo could almost pass for one of the Tysakane. It was hard to believe he was the same hapless dreamer who used to walk into walls while reading. Horizons instead of books, riding instead of reading. It was a different life out here, but make no mistake, Laszlo was every bit the dreamer he had always been, if not more. He might have left his books behind, but he carried all his stories with him, out of the glaive-lit nooks of the library, and into landscapes far more fit for them. Like this one. He straightened the fog net and peered over it at the cusp. He thought at first that it was a mirage. In the midst of the Elmuthaleth, sky had met ground in an unbroken circle, flat and featureless, as far as the eye could see. To travel across it, day after day, for weeks, to make and break camp each dusk and dawn, with a sameness that merged the days to a blur, it defied the mind to believe that it could end. When the first shimmer had appeared in the distance, he thought it must be an illusion, like the lakes they sometimes saw that vanished as they drew near. But this hadn't vanished. Over the past several days, it had grown from a pale streak on the horizon to, well, to the cusp, whatever the cusp was. It formed the eastern edge of the Elmuthaleth, and the other Ferengi were content to call it a mountain range, but it didn't look like a mountain range. It lacked peaks. The entire formation, a kind of immense mound, was white, from the dun desert floor to the blue of the sky. It looked like milky crystal, or perhaps ice. Or, it looked like what the myths said it was.
Almost there. Hard to believe.
It was Calixte's voice. She was one of the other Ferengi. Coming up beside Laszlo to share the view, she pushed back the hood of her shulno to reveal her fine, small head. It had been naked as an egg the first time Laszlo saw her, forcibly shaved, as his own had once been, and just as crudely. But her hair was growing in now. It was a soft brown fluff, like fledgling plumage. Her bruises were long gone, but she still had scars where her manacles had rubbed her wrists and ankles raw. Calixte was not only the first girl Laszlo counted as a friend, but also the first criminal.
"By this time tomorrow," he said.
He didn't need to finish the thought. The anticipation was palpable. By this time tomorrow, they would be there. They would climb the single track that led through Fort Mizrach to the top of the cusp, and they would get their first sight of that which lay beyond it. Weep.
"Last chance for a theory,"
said Calixte. Her ragged notebook was in her hands. She held it up and flapped it like a butterfly.
"You don't give up, do you?" "It's been said. Look, there's one page left."
She showed him.
"I saved it for you."
"You shouldn't have."
"Yes, I should. Don't think I'm letting you reach the cusp without giving me at least one."
One theory. When the delegates had met up in Alkenost, they had assumed they would be enlightened as to the reason for their journey. The nature of Weep's problem, as it were. They'd earned that much, surely, by coming so far. And when Errol Fane rose to his feet at the head of the table at their first shared meal, they'd waited with hushed expectancy for the information that was their due. The next morning, they would set foot to the great and terrible Elmuthaleth. It was only fair that they should know why, and preferably while they could still turn back if they chose.
"In your time among us,"
Errol Fane had told them then,
"you will be called upon to believe things you would not, at this moment, find it possible to believe. You are rational men and women who believe what you can see and prove. Nothing would be gained by telling you now. On the contrary, you will find that the relentless nothingness of the Elmuthaleth has a way of amplifying the workings of your mind. I would sooner it amplify your curiosity than your skepticism.
In other words, it's a surprise. And so they'd gone on in mystery, but not without resentments and a vast deal of speculation. The crossing had been hard, bleak and monotonous, physically and mentally grueling. The theory purse had been Calixte's idea, and a good one. Laszlo had seen how it gave the others a spark of life, to play a game of sorts, to have something to win. It didn't hurt that they liked to hear themselves talk, and it gave them opportunity. It was simple. You made a guess as to what the problem was, and Calixte wrote it down in her book. You could make as many guesses as you wanted, but each one cost 10 silver, paid into the purse, which was a shabby affair of old green brocade, held closed with a gaudy brooch. Calixte said it had been her grandmother's, but then she also said she came from a family of assassins, or else a family of acrobats, depending on her mood, so it was hard to know what to believe. Once they reached Weep and all was revealed, whoever had made the closest guess would win the purse, which was up to some 500 silver now, and bursting at its frayed green seams. Laszlo had not entered a theory into the book.
There couldn't possibly be an idea left unclaimed, he said.
Well, there's not a boring one left unclaimed, that's for certain. If I hear one more manly variation on the conquest theory, I might kill myself. But you can do better. I know you can. You're a storyteller. Dream up something wild and improbable, she pleaded. Something beautiful and full of monsters.
Beautiful and full of monsters.
All the best stories are.
Laszlo didn't disagree with that. He made a final adjustment to the net and turned back toward camp.
It isn't a story contest, though.
Calixte fell into step beside him.
But it is. It's a true story contest. And I think the truth must be stranger than that lot is fit to dream up.
She flicked her notebook dismissively toward the center of camp, where the rest of the Ferengi were gathered, waiting for their dinner to be cooked for them. They'd early established themselves in the role of guests, most of them anyway, and were content to stand idle, while the caravan drovers in the Tizercane, and Laszlo, saw to all the work. They had already covered their lightweight shulno with their heavy woolen ones against the coming evening chill, proof that not one joule of energy had been converted to heat by means of respectable labor. With their hoods up and their purposeless milling, Laszlo thought they looked like a pack of ghosts on coffee break.
Maybe not, he allowed.
So it's all up to you, said Calixte. You can't help but come up with a strange idea. Any idea you have is a strange idea. Get it?
Laszlo laughed in spite of himself. Usually plays on his name were much less good-humoured.
I'm not a member of the delegation, he reminded her.
What was he? Storyteller and secretary, and doer of odd jobs. Neither Tizercane nor delegate. Just someone along for the dream.
But you are a Ferengi, she countered.
And this was true, though he didn't fit with the rest of them. He'd ridden into their cities mounted on a spectral, after all, and most of them assumed he was from Weep, at least until Thion Nero disabused them of that notion.
He's just an orphan peasant from Zosma, you know,
he'd said, lest they be tempted to feel anything like respect for him.
Even if I won, Laszlo said to Calixte, the others would just say I already had the answer from Errol Fane.
I don't care what they'd say, Calixte replied. It's my game. I decide the winner, and I believe you.
And Laszlo was surprised by the strength of his gratitude. To be believed, even by a Tomb Raider from a family of assassins. Or perhaps especially by a Tomb Raider from a family of assassins. Or acrobats, depending on her mood. Calixte, like he, didn't fit with the rest. But she, unlike he, was a member of the delegation. The most puzzling member, perhaps, and the least anticipated. She was even a surprise to Errol Fane, who'd gone to Syriza seeking a builder, not an acrobat. It was their first destination after Zosma, and so Laszlo's first experience as the Godslayer's secretary had been the recruitment of Eblis Todd, builder of the Cloud Spire, tallest structure in the world. And what a structure it was. It looked like an enormous auger shell, or a unicorn's horn, upthrust from the earth, and was said to stand at over 600 feet. It was a simple, elegant spiral, windowless and unadorned. Syriza was known for its spires, and this was the king of them all. Errol Fane had been duly impressed, and had agreed to Eblis Todd's every demand in order to woo him to weep. A formal contract was prepared by Laszlo, in his official capacity, and signed, and the unseen party was set to continue its journey, when Laszlo mentioned a bit of gossip he'd heard. That a girl had climbed the Cloud Spire. Without ropes, he'd relayed to Errol Fane. Only her hands and bare feet, wedged in the single cleft that ran spiral from the base of the tower to its tip.
And did she reach the top?
Errol Fane had wanted to know, squinting up at the tower to gauge the feasibility of such a feat.
They say so. Apparently they've put her in jail for it.
Jail? For climbing a tower?
For raiding a tomb,
Laszlo corrected. Never mind that the man for whom it had been built was still living. The Cloud Spire was a royal tomb, and all manner of luxuries had already been laid in for the king's post-mortal comfort. Besides the oculus at the top, for the respiration of souls, there was only one way in. It was never left unguarded, but when a treasurer entered the tomb with his arms full of itzal, jars containing the souls of animals, the practice of slave itzal and wife itzal having been, happily, abolished, he found a girl sitting cross-legged on the jeweled sarcophagus, juggling emeralds. She confirmed that she had scaled the spire and entered through the oculus, but claimed she hadn't come to steal. She was only practicing her juggling, she said. Wouldn't anyone do the same? When Errol Fane went to the jail and found a bruised, bald waif in rusty manacles, half-starved and defending herself with a nail, he asked her why she'd done it. And she replied with pride,
"Because I could."
And Laszlo supposed that must also be the reason he had brought her along with them. Because she could climb a 600-foot tower with only her small hands and bare feet. He didn't know why this skill might be of value. It was a piece of the puzzle. Eblis Todd, a man who could build a tower. Calixte de Gaz, a girl who could climb one. Thion Nero, the alchemist who had distilled Azoth. Jonwit Balabra, mathematician. Fathmus Muzave, natural philosopher, liked to declare that his field was no less than the physical laws of the universe, but whose focus, in reality, was somewhat narrower. Magnetic fields. K. Ilferth, engineer. The Fellerings, metallurgists, twin brothers. Fortune Kether, an artist, renowned publicly for his frescoes, and privately for the catapults and siege engines he designed for skirmishing kings. Drave. Just Drave, a so-called explosionist, whose job was setting blast charges in mines, and whose credits included blowing the sides off of mountains. Sulzerin and Oswin Eo, a married couple. She a mechanist, he a farmer botanist, who together had invented a craft they called a silk sleigh, a craft that could fly.
These were the Godslayer's delegates. Being told nothing more of the problem in Weep than that it was the shadow of a dark time, the only real clue they